Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, live from Los Angeles, broadcasting live from our studios at KTLK K-Talk in L.A. And a tip of the hat and many thanks to the fine folks here, John Quinlan, Don Martin, and company, who have made it possible for us to use the studios and get our show on the air. Had a fascinating, great book signing last night at Barnes & Noble. Tonight, we'll be out in Ventura County, the Ventura County Democrats. I'll give you a little more information on that later. It's Friday, as always, the first hour of our Friday program, our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov is his website, the independent from Vermont, literally an independent, not a member of the Democratic or Republican parties. And I think of him as America's senator, sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. What's on your radar screen? I'm guessing with Vermont, the low-income heating.
That's right. That's one of the issues that is out there. You know, I've been, the Congress has been on break now for the Thanksgiving week, and it's actually a two-week break. So I've been running around the state, you know, talking to a lot of people in a lot of ways. And, you know, what you're hearing out here is certainly a frustration that Congress is not moving as aggressively as it should, in dealing with Bush's disastrous agenda in so many areas, whether it's Iraq, whether it's the economy, whether it's the decline and collapse of our healthcare system, whether it's the growing gap between the very, very rich and everybody else, whether it's the issue of civil liberties. There is that frustration, and I think it is very clear that Congress is going to have to get more focused and take on a president who may well go down in history as the worst president that we have ever had. And one example, Tom, of just how off the wall this president's priorities are is that every listener knows that the cost of heating fuel is just soaring up, whether it's oil, whether it's propane, whether it's kerosene, whatever it may be. And certainly that impacts cold weather states like the state of Vermont. There is, as I think many listeners know, a long-established federal program called LIHEAP, Low-Income Heating Assistance Program, which provides fuel, provides help for people in keeping warm in the wintertime. And many of those people, in fact, are seniors trying to get by on Social Security. What our friend in the White House has done is at a time when he is fighting for more tax breaks for billionaires, when he is spending $300 million a day in Iraq, he thinks that we should cut the LIHEAP program, despite the fact that the fuel costs are soaring. That will be a major struggle as we return to Congress next week. I have introduced, will be introducing as soon as we get back, legislation which now has a good cross-section of bipartisan supporters to increase funding by $1 billion. To make sure that in this very tough winter when prices are so high that no one in America goes cold. So,
Bernie, may I offer an unsolicited suggestion?
Sure.
I find it amazing that the Republicans have been so successful at naming legislation in ways that are Orwellian, you know, the Healthy Skies, or
right.
The Healthy Forests Initiative that cuts forests, the Clear Skies Initiative that
cuts
pollution, right. But the Democrats never do this. I mean, you've got a great program for low-income children to have health insurance, and instead of calling it the Save Our Children Act, it's called the S-CHIP program. It sounds like something, if you say it wrong, you can't, you know, you lose your license to be on the radio. LIHEAP sounds like it's a program for liars who pile up in a heap or something. I mean, it's a, let's give this thing a name. Name your legislation something like the, you know, saving our elderly and low-income friends, or saving our friends and neighbors in winter, or something like that. I mean, you know, brainstorm something and come up with a title for it. That's
a very good point. Yeah, and I think it's exactly what we will do. And how you're right, Republicans have done a very good job in framing, coming up with sound bites.
Oh, the Patriot Act. I mean, it takes away our civil rights.
Anyhow, that's an issue that I think people will be hearing a lot when Congress reconvenes. You'll also be hearing a lot about global warming. There's global warming legislation that is moving down the pike. In my view, and I've mentioned this before, what the scientists are now telling us is that the pro- problem of global warming is probably more severe than they had previously believed to be the case. That's the bad news. The good news is really that we know how to address this problem. I just met this morning, as a matter of fact, here in Vermont, with a couple of utility executives, heads of some of the largest utilities in the state of Vermont. We are sitting on the potential of making great gains in terms of energy efficiencies, in terms of not only weatherizing our homes and driving cars that get reasonable mileage per gallon. The energy bill, which will be coming up shortly, hopefully, will raise fuel efficiency standards to at least 35 miles per gallon. The refrigerators that we're using in our homes now, in many cases, are very energy inefficient. We're not using enough of compact fluorescent. The LED light bulb is about to make some significant breakthroughs in terms of home use, commercial use, which can use one-tenth the electricity of what an incandescent light bulb can do. So there's a lot of potential with energy efficiency. There's going to be some major solar thermal plants being built in the southwest of this country, which will produce almost as much electricity as a nuclear power plant. Huge potential out there. Cost of the photovoltaics are going to go down. Wind, both large wind farms and small wind turbines for individual homes, are also going to be making significant gains. So the goal is to break our dependency on fossil fuel, move in a very significant way toward energy efficiency and toward sustainable energy. And that's sitting there waiting to happen. And what we need is a federal government. We need state governments to begin to have the political will to make that happen.
Yeah, that's great. What else is on your agenda here?
We have some good news, I think, for our veterans. In my view, the federal government has, for many, many years, underfunded the needs of the VA. Just a piece in the paper yesterday about veterans who have to wait just endless periods of time when they process a claim for the benefits to which they are entitled. And what you're seeing from this war in Iraq is a whole lot of folks coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury, and they're processing a lot of claims. The VA doesn't have the resources, doesn't have the people to process these claims in a timely manner. So what you will see very, very shortly is a bill that will be passed and signed by the president, which will provide the largest increase in funding for veterans in the history of the VA. And what we have to do in that bill is make sure that, A, we're taking care of the guys and women who are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and, B, that we have to make sure we're also not forgetting the older veterans who, in many cases, are in waiting lines trying to get into hospitals and clinics. So that's an issue. Of course, the issue of how we end this never-ending war in Iraq will be resurfacing again, and I will be supporting legislation which will bring our troops home as soon as possible. One of the concerns that I think more and more people are having is that while the good news is the violence is down in Iraq, the bad news is the violence is up in Afghanistan, which is where we'll all remember Osama bin Laden was hiding out when 9/11 took place. So how we can deal with the Taliban and their gains in Afghanistan, how we can deal with the instability in Pakistan, how we can deal with international terrorism in a lot better way than we're doing with Bush is an issue that will be talked about a whole lot.
Yeah. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the subprime mortgage crisis and what can be done. And also, your colleague, Pat Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, what do you think is going to be the fate of the contempt citations that he's been talking about to the administration?
Well, I applaud him for issuing those citations. I think after 6 years, I mean, one of the many outrages of the Bush administration has been that they got away with murder and that there was no investigative committee that asked them any hard questions at all, whether it was about Iraq, whether it was about civil liberties, whether it was about Blackwater or Halliburton. These guys got away with murder. Now people like Leahy are beginning to ask the right questions. And I think the American people want to hear answers. Now he's dealing with the U.S. attorney situation. And what's so important is if you have U.S. attorneys, what kind of faith are people going to have in the legal system if you have political appointees who are making decisions based on political considerations rather than on justice? And I think we have a right to know who it was and what were the motives for the firing, for the proposed firing of these attorneys and how high it went up the administrative food chain.
And some of them who stayed in office. I mean, it looks like Don Siegelman down in Alabama is our first political prisoner. You know, that he was targeted for prosecution and, you know, just as a political ploy.
Right. That's something we want to look at, right?
Pretty scary stuff. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. He'll be taking your calls, 1-866-303-2270. If you want to drop into our live chat room, we've reconfigured our website. So go to TomHartmann.com and just click live chat up at the top. It'll get you there. The blog, of course, over at AirAmerica.com. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Coming down. The hardest thing.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. I'll be live tonight, by the way, for our listeners in Ventura County and in Oak Park at the Ventura County Democrats Speakers Series. It's from 7 to 9. It's open to the public. It's free, although they say if you can make a small contribution, the party would certainly appreciate it. That's at 1000 Canaan Road. I think that's how it's pronounced. K-A-N-A-N. Maybe it's Cannon Road. In Oak Park, and I'll be there at 7 o'clock, so be there or be square. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. He's got a great newsletter also. You can sign up for it on that website. And, Bernie, before we go to the calls, John Fish, a fellow who's driving me around L.A. here today, a member of our chat room and listener to the show, just suggested an acronym for you for your bill.
Okay.
WARM, W-A-R-M, the Winter Assistance Reliability Maintenance.
Okay. That sounds good.
So we're going to promote the WARM program. Well,
okay.
It's an idea. Okay. Don in Huntington, Delaware, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, the dollar keeps falling. Is the government going to do anything about it? And with the Fed talking about cutting the rates, isn't that going to cause the dollar to go down even further?
That is a very good question and a very good point. Obviously, the speed at which the dollar is falling is alarming many, many people. I think you will see action. What exactly will take place, I really just can't tell you.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice if we all had crystal balls? Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, thanks for working for us, vets.
Thank you.
Question involves basically the sovereign wealth funds, Abu Dhabi, communist China, and other foreign kingdoms and dictatorships are buying Citibank and other U.S. companies?
Yep.
Well, calling them sovereign wealth funds is sort of an Orwellian doublespeak, since the funds obviously serve the political as well as the economic goals of their kings and dictators. So my question is this. As Saudi, Russian, and communist Chinese governments buy more and more U.S. stocks, how long should the Fed and U.S. taxpayers continue to protect, subsidize, and bail out these U.S. corporate Trojan horses?
Ralph, you raise a very good question, and you make a very good point. And I think it is an issue Tom and I have talked about in the past, but I think does not get enough discussion. I think what many Americans are aware of is that corporate America has shut down many, many plants, moving many jobs to China, other low-wage countries. People are more or less aware of that, and we're going to have a whole lot of debate on trade policy and how we can change that so that companies start reinvesting in this country rather than in China. But people are aware of that. What people, in fact, are not aware of is the degree to which foreign interests are increasingly owning the United States of America. And the extraordinary power that appears to be growing every single day on the part of China and other countries to influence economic and political decisions in the United States. I think this is an issue of huge consequence. What I got to say is that many of my friends in the Congress, in the Senate, apparently do not. And it is an issue that we have to raise consciousness about. Because if we do not, we're not going to be controlling our own destiny. And I know, Tom, you and I have talked about this in the past. And, in fact, I think there's a very good website out there which talks just about that issue.
Economyandcrisis.org, I believe it is.
Which talks about foreign ownership of American industry and so forth.
Yeah, they chronicle it. 15,000 companies now in the last 20-some-odd years and major corporations, you know, multi-billion, a trillion dollars, over $1 trillion of America sold off. And it's basically to you know, we're borrowing money from them so that we can buy their stuff because we've outsourced our jobs to them. And then they take that borrowed money and they say, okay, cool. Now we've got these dollars. Where can we spend them? In the United States. I guess I'll buy Citibank. Stuff like that.
Yeah. No, this is just the issue. What I have to say in answer to Ralph, this issue really is not on the radar screen anywhere near where it should be in the Congress.
Yeah, do you think that we just have 15 seconds here before break? Do you think that that might have something to do with campaign contributions?
Of course it does. I mean, it's the same thing as a trade policy. We have trade policies which have failed us year after year. Deficit is growing larger. We lose more and more jobs. And yet people, you know, Bush and his friends want to continue these disastrous policies. But I think you have, you know, many members of the Congress who see their major obligation in life as worrying about multinational corporations and the interests of CEOs rather than ordinary people. And that kind of blinds them to the reality of what foreign ownership of the United States means.
Yeah. Okay. We've got about a half a minute here. Roger in Rhode Island. A quick question for Bernie.
Yeah, Bernie, I have a couple of quick issues I'd like to comment on. One is defunding the No Child Left Behind. What's the chances of that? The other is passing a bill that says it's illegal to for any corporation to benefit from war and war profiteering.
Well, actually, I just held in Burlington, Vermont, a few nights ago, a big meeting on No Child Left Behind. A lot of anger against that bill. I'm on the committee that deals with that, and I think my hope is that you will see major, major changes in that legislation.
Great. And we can get to war profiteering after the break if you'd like. 27 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders.Senate.gov is website. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Stick around. Ah, yes, he's out there. The man from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders.Senate.gov. Hey, Bernie.
Okay, Tom, let's go right back to Roger's question.
Yeah, okay.
About war profiteering. In fact, the Senate did pass language to set up what I guess could be looked at as somewhat like a Truman Commission. You remember the Truman Commission of War Profiteering in World War II?
Yep.
So to answer Roger, yeah, there is an effort to do that and to take a hard look at the no-bid contracts given to companies like Halliburton and others. In addition to that, I think we need to take a very hard look at the whole privatization of our military and what it means that you have companies like Blackwater and others that are operating militarily without being under the influence or the control of the United States government, what the hell that means.
Right.
What it means in terms of public policy and who's running the show, and also what it means to the morale of our men and women in the armed forces who are working alongside of people who may be making 10 times as much money as they do, what it means in seeing the best people that we have leaving the military to go work for the private contractors because the pay is so much better. Big issue out there. We're looking at that as well. But it also touches on, by the way, the whole effort on the part of Bush and his right-wing friends to privatize even the domestic federal workforce, of which they continue to try to do. We're dealing right now in Vermont, for example, with a situation where workers work for the federal government doing immigration work. They had been contracted out a while ago. The new contractor is basically substantially lowering wages for these guys who are doing, you know, they're doing the same work. They're going to see a major reduction in their wages, which we're working on. But this whole issue of privatization in the military and our domestic workforce is a big deal.
Yeah, indeed. By the way, in naming your legislation, our listeners are getting involved here. Cynthia in Alameda, California says you should call it the SOS program, Seasonal Oil Savings.
So we got warm and we got SOS. We should do some kind of contest. That's right.
Yeah, I mean,
now,
you know,
name that legislation.
Yeah, you've got here's your online think tank: the Winter Assistance Reliability Maintenance or the Seasonal Oil Savings, Warm or SOS. So
we'll make the announcement next week as to what the title of the bill is.
There you go. Okay, great. George in Los Angeles, California, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Keep warm is simple.
Yeah,
but you know what? My complaint is that I'm paying taxes and the administration is privatizing the roads, so I have to pay to get on the roads, the schools, the army, and for a third world country that we apparently are becoming, we have mercenary forces training in this country, like Blackwater, and the brother of the owner of Blackwater oversees Blackwater. What kind of sense is that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you, this is just the issue we were talking about a moment ago. And from Bush's perspective, any policy that makes money, large amounts of profits for private corporations is a good idea. And what you want to do is destroy the ability of government in general to deliver services in a cost-effective way. To my mind, and I say this not just as a U.S. senator, but as a former mayor, the most cost-effective way of delivering services for taxpayers is to have a well-trained group of people who have high morale, who see their work in a career, as a career, and where turnover is not high. And I think when you have that situation, you can deliver services in a cost-effective way. Very often what this privatization is about, it looks cheap up front, looks cheap tomorrow. Then you have turnover. You got to retrain people. You have lower quality work. You have people who are not dedicated. And in the long run, the work is not as good and the cost is greater.
Yeah, Bernie, there was an article in the current issue of Vanity Fair about one of the defense contractors. And just almost anecdotally, they made the point that the amount of money that the federal government is now spending on private contractors, on the privatization of government functions across the board, is equal to the collected taxes of every taxpayer in America who makes $100,000 or less.
Wow.
100% of all the tax income from $100,000 or less taxpayers is mind-boggling.
And, but, you know, these guys are very, very radical. It's not just that they want to privatize Social Security, privatize Medicare, privatize the post office, privatize public education, if you like. I mean, they are even, as we have said, moving aggressively to privatize the United States military.
Yeah.
Very radical and very dangerous.
Indeed. Phyllis in Florida, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Phyllis?
Yes.
Hey, you're on
the
air.
I'm sorry. What I wanted to know was MoveOn.org sent me an email today about the bases that are being built in Iraq and the embassy, which is the largest in the world, for us permanently staying there. I'd like to know what Congress is going to do about this.
Well, you raise a very good question. I think that information is correct. The embassy in Iraq, I believe, will be our largest embassy in the world. And the signal that that type of embassy gives out is that we're there to stay and that we're there to dominate the region and not be a player but just a dominant force. And I think that's just the message, exactly the message that you don't want that part of the world to believe to be true, and it shouldn't be true. So I think what Move On is saying is true, and it's an issue that has got to be addressed.
Philip in Happy Valley, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Please pick up your phone, Philip.
I'm reading a car produced in India. It runs on air. It has no pollution. Have you heard anything about that and why it can't be produced and sold in the United States?
This is an automobile that runs on air?
Runs on air.
It's on compressed air.
You can get 125 miles on a compressed air tank. It costs $2 at one of their fill-ups to fill it up. And it'll go up to 70 miles an hour.
Is it on the market in India now?
Yes. And in Mexico City, they use them as taxi cabs.
You know,
I'm sorry, Philip. We just lost Philip.
Oh, no, I mean, I will look into that. No, I haven't, to be honest with you. I haven't heard that. I've driven electric cars. I've driven retrofitted Toyota Priuses, which got 150 miles per gallon. I've driven hydrogen cars, but I have not driven an air car. Are you familiar with that technology, Tom?
I've seen articles about it. I thought that it was a development, you know, something in development, a concept car, but it may be that they're in production now.
Okay.
I don't know either.
That's interesting. I'll certainly take a look at it.
Yeah. David in Queens, New York. You're on the air with Bernie Sanders. Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, how's it going? There's a lot of scandals within the Bush administration, like the firing of the U.S. attorneys, the CIA leak case. But the big scandal that the media is trying to hide is the fact that AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, is under investigation for spying in the Pentagon. I mean, basically, they were...
I'm sorry, Bernie, I'm going to cut him off.
Yeah.
There's a small cadre of people who are convinced that Israel and the Jews are behind all evil things in the world, and that AIPAC is their point person, and I'm just, you know, I'm not even going to debate the. I'm not going to go there. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Dennis in Alexandria, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Sam, Senator, and Mr. Hartman. My question is, if we're serious about solving the Social Security problem in this country, why not tax all income instead of just the first $96,000?
Well, Dennis, you're right.
Yeah.
I think if you
eliminate
do,
the cap, okay, solves the problem.
Yeah, and if you do that, I think you've pretty much. Yeah, I mean, 2 points that I would make. Number one, it is not true that Social Security is in crisis today. Social Security has enough funds to pay off every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 30-plus years. But at a certain point, there may not be enough money coming in, and I think the solution that we should be moving toward is precisely eliminating the cap. It is wrong that, you know, multi-millionaires are paying into the system the same as people who make, I think it's $92,000, $93,000, Tom.
Yeah. Dave in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air.
Tom, Bernie. There's a car out there that you can charge up at night when it's low power and recharge everything that you're cooking with in the morning. You switch a switch and it goes from, and then your car actually powers your house.
Right.
Say no to Bill 1955 and 1954, or 9. The question I have is that there was an analysis done of this crash of the 1930s. And there's a lot of stop gaps put in the financial market, housing market, hundreds of them, and goes very deep. And the program I saw on PBS said since 2000, and this was about a year ago I saw the program, and they said that all of them had been removed, and they said all of them. And they said good luck. And what's your outlook?
Well...
seen the outcome of deregulation, aren't we? Deregulation of the banking industry and the mortgage industry. And
I think, you know, way back when I was in the House, I was on the Financial Services Committee. I think, I won't swear to you, but I may have been the only person on that committee to vote against interstate banking, among other things. And I think there clearly has been a major effort toward deregulation, which then leads you to that proposition of too big to fail, where you have so much power and wealth and a handful of institutions that if they fail, they will then bring down the economy unto itself. So I don't know that all of the regulatory barriers have been knocked down. I don't think that is the case, but the caller makes a good point.
Yeah, yeah. It is a grim one. Chuck in San Jose, we got about a half a minute here, Chuck, before we got to take a break.
Yeah, hi. Bill Bradley has a book out, New American Story, and says that if we adopt the European MPG at 43, we wouldn't have to import any OPEC oil. If that's true, what do we have to do to get to that? Because that would end this squabbling over in the war.
Well, what I have heard, you know, is that if we had comparable mileage per gallon to Europe, which is about 44 miles per gallon, we would not have to import any oil from Saudi Arabia. I don't know if it's all of OPEC. The answer is we have had tremendous resistance from the Detroit automakers. The goal is, the hope is, that maybe we can get 35 miles per gallon CAFE standards to be phased in, and that will be passed in an energy bill, hopefully, in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah. And we really should shoot for higher.
Yes.
45 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website. It's the Brunch with Bernie Hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, as he has for going on 5 years now, I think, every Friday here on this program. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Joe in Detroit, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, guys. One of the things I wanted to say, just a comment along the lines that you talked about naming the bill, Tom, we ought to use language like up or down vote with these guys, and in the filibuster, make them stand up on C-SPAN and block all this legislation and be public. But my question to Senator Sanders is, I get so tired as an activist Democrat of hearing we don't have the votes to stop the war. Why don't we just take the bill that the president vetoes when it comes back, change the number at the top, vote on it again, and send it back. and do that 20 or 30 times. He can't say that he's blocking, that we're not providing the funds. Why don't we just do that, Bernie?
Well, that's an idea, Joe. I think, to be honest with you, I think we have not been as aggressive as we should. We certainly don't have 60 votes to end debate. I think your idea about letting these debates go on, and if they go on all night, they go on all night, and if they go on to the next day, is the right thing to do. But I think what you will begin to see is more aggressiveness in not funding this war, and I think your point is a good one.
Robert in Hadley, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, Senator Sanders, my question is kind of simple. I'm a Vietnam vet and suffering from the residuals of Agent Orange, pretty much changed my whole life. And my concern is that, is the VA going to be prepared to deal with the number of vets coming back from Iraq, the wounded, and people that have faced post-traumatic stress disorder? Because I see an increasing amount through my association with the VA of people that are suffering from Agent Orange and geriatrics, of course, from World War II.
Well, Robert, you asked an excellent question, and I don't have to tell you how hard the Vietnam vets had to fight their own government to make the case that Agent Orange was such a lethal chemical and how many illnesses that it caused. I was a little bit involved in that regarding diabetes. What I can tell you is that the Congress will provide the largest increase in the history of the VA precisely to begin addressing not only all those who have already been wounded in Iraq, and we're talking almost 30,000, but the many, many thousands who are going to be coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder and TBR. And you're asking, do they now have the capabilities of addressing that? Probably not. And that's why we're giving them the money and we're demanding that they get their act together. I can tell you that in the state of Vermont, we recently brought some $3 million in the state to expand an outreach program to make our veterans here, Iraqi veterans, knowledgeable about the services that are available to them, develop better cooperation between the National Guard and the VA. I think that is probably not happening around the rest of the country. So to answer your question, Congress is beginning to appropriate the kinds of money that we need, and we're going to push the VA to do everything they can to make sure that they are prepared to help the many, many thousands of soldiers who are going to come home with a variety of problems.
Okay. Craig in San Jose, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, thanks, Tom, and Senator Sanders. My question was about the global warming bill that you mentioned earlier with the 35 mile per gallon requirement. As, in my opinion, it's pathetically weak to get 35 miles per gallon by 2020. But my question is, I've heard there's a loophole in this thing big enough to drive a truck through that all the president has to do is submit a cost-benefit analysis to Congress showing that this standard would put too much of a financial hardship on the automakers, and the requirements would be waived. Is my information?
That bill is now in conference committee, and I think they are working on it and working on the fine language of it, fine tuning it as we speak. So I don't know that, Craig. I would certainly agree with you that 35 miles per hour in the year 2020 is quite weak. But I just have to tell you that the opposition, and believe me, to get that required a major, major struggle. What we're up against is a very reactionary automobile industry who, while they continue to lose market share, seem to have their heads in the sand and just do not want to go forward in terms of energy-efficient automobiles. So it's been a struggle to get where we are. But there's no question to my mind that we have to be much more aggressive.
William in Memphis, Tennessee. We have 1 minute to go here. William, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, we have a situation now where the media is, through omission, hiding the truth about what's going on in so many areas and the consolidation of media. We need a minister of information, like in dictatorships, overseas.
Talk about naming things. I don't know that I would call somebody a minister of information.
But we at least need at the congressional level an investigation of what these suckers are doing to us, and we don't have an informed electorate, and we can't. and that is a major impedance to our democracy.
Well, you know, Will, what I could say is I'm not quite in favor of a minister of information, but, you know, this whole issue of media consolidation, it's, again, an issue that Tom and I have talked and many listeners have talked about for many years, is very, very important. And I think what Will is referring to is the fact that fewer and fewer large media conglomerates are owning and controlling what the American people see, hear, and read. And the issue of omission is exactly right. There are, well, many issues that we don't talk about that are of enormous importance while we worry about Paris Hilton and Britney Spears and so forth and so on. So it's an important point, one that will be discussed very strongly and dealt with, I hope, in the Congress.
Yeah, the top story on CNN yesterday, CNN.com. O.J. Simpson pleads not guilty.
Well, there you go.
Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Thank you, Bernie.
Okay, Tom, take care. Bye.
Great having you here. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. We're going to do a presidential straw poll right now, a Democratic primary presidential straw poll right this minute. If you call 1-866-303-2270, and just it'll just ring. Lauren's not going to answer the phone like normal. It'll just ring, and I will put you on the air. You will hear the sound that typically comes. We're doing this right this minute. So you can start dialing right now. Well, I will put you on the air. You'll hear the little psst, which says that you're on the air. And I may call out your area code number so that you know that it's you. And just tell us who you would vote for if the primary were held today. We're going to do this segment a little shorter than normal so that you know, we can get this in and get this out of the way, because I'm curious to see where America's standing right now. So we'll be taking calls from all over the country. Who would you vote for if the election was today? Area code 619. Who would you vote for?
Oh, I would vote for Kucinich.
Okay. Area code 818, who would you vote for?
John Edwards.
John Edwards. Area code 601, who would you vote for?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 206, your vote.
Yeah. Hello?
Yeah.
This is Tom.
Who would you vote for if you were voting today in the Democratic primary?
Democrat. I think I'd vote for Edwards.
Okay, thank you. Area code 732, who would you vote for today?
Al Gore and John Edwards.
Okay, great, thank you. 317, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, 541, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 707, who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 805, who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you very much. Area code 973, who would you vote for today?
Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. Area code 646, for whom would you vote today? Area 646?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Area code 310, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 310, who would you vote for today?
Edwards.
951, your vote?
John Edwards.
Area code 360, your vote?
Yes.
Your vote?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 303, your vote today?
Yes, Kucinich.
Okay. Area 917, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 818, your vote today?
Barack Obama.
Okay. Area code 612, your vote today?
Kucinich.
Area code, thank you. Area code 760, your vote?
John Edwards.
Area 6, thank you. Area 631, your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Area 503, your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area 206, your vote?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area 503, your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Area 718, your vote today?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Barack Obama.
Thank you very much. Area code 310, your vote today?
Barack Obama.
Okay. Area code 510, who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 805, your vote?
Edwards Hartman.
Yeah, right. We'll register that as Edwards. Thank you. Area code 562, your vote today?
Kucinich.
Thank you very much. Area code 503, your vote today?
Honest John Edwards.
Okay. Area code 503, your vote today?
Kucinich.
Okay. That one went away. Okay. Area code 404, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 952, your vote today?
Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 720, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Okay. Area code 541, your vote today?
I would vote for Dennis Kucinich, big time.
Thank you. Area code 253, who would you vote for today?
Kucinich or Edwards.
Okay, we'll mark one of each. Area code 505, for whom would you vote today?
Kucinich.
Thank you very much. Area code 323, your vote today?
Kucinich.
Okay, 214, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 310, your vote today?
Edwards.
Okay. Area code 313, your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Area 904, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Okay. Area code 808, your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Area code 970, your vote today? Your vote, 970?
Kucinich and then Edwards.
Okay. Area code 816, your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Area 602, your vote today?
Pardon?
For whom would you vote today if the primary were held?
Edwards,
okay.
Definitely.
Thank you. Area code 814, your vote today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Area code 626, your vote? 626?
John Edwards.
Okay. 586, your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. 412, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Okay. Area code 714, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Okay. Area code 949, your vote today?
Straight up, John Edwards.
Okay. Area code 714, your vote today?
Yes, I would vote for Reverend Dan.
Reverend Dan, okay. We have a write-in here. Area code 480, your vote today?
Kucinich and Gore.
Okay. We'll put down one for each. Area code 973, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Okay. Area code 602, your vote today?
Clinton.
Okay. Hillary Clinton. Area code 425, your vote today?
Kucinich.
Okay. Area code 541, your vote today?
Kucinich. Exactly.
Okay. Yep. Okay. I'm sorry about that. Area code 269, your vote today?
I would vote for John Edwards.
Okay. Thank you. Area code 435, your vote?
John Edwards.
Okay. Thank you. Area code 206, your vote?
Kucinich Edwards.
Okay. Thank you. Area code 941, your vote? Area code 97. Got to listen to the phone. Area code 978, your vote?
Hi, Al Gore.
Al Gore, okay. Area code 860, your vote?
Yeah, Barack Obama.
Okay, thank you. Area code 503, your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 510, your vote?
Clinton.
Okay, thank you. Area code 310, your vote?
Obama.
Thank you. Area code 319, your vote?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 214, your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, I've got a... thank you very much. Area code 248, your vote?
Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 504, your vote?
Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden.
Okay, thank you very much. Area code 978, your vote?
Yes, the only true Democrat, Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, area code 303, your vote?
Clinton.
Okay. Our number, by the way, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, area code 503, your vote?
Kucinich.
Thank you. Area code 646, your vote? 646, you're on the air? Okay, they're not. Area code 707, your vote today?
Ralph Nader.
Okay, oh, that's interesting. Area code 602, your vote today?
Hillary Clinton.
Okay, area code 720, your vote today?
Clinton Edwards.
Clinton Edwards, okay. Area code 609, your vote today?
John Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 646, your vote?
Edwards.
Thank you. Area code 707, your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay. Area code 201, your vote?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, and that'll wrap it up. 13 minutes past the hour. We'll give you the tally right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Yep, it's Anything Goes Friday. Your calls on any topic you'd like. There's a couple of topics I'd like to bring up. I'll mention briefly. We just finished our presidential straw poll, our Democratic primary straw poll on the Tom Hartman program here for the week. And here's the results tallied up by John Fish here in Los Angeles, who's helping out, driving me around yesterday and today. And thanks, tip of the hat to John for that. Thank you. And the winner was John Edwards with 36 votes, number two, and close behind, Dennis Kucinich with 32 votes. Senator Clinton with 7 votes and Senator Obama with 7 votes, a tie for third place. Fourth place, Al Gore with three votes, essentially a write-in vote. Fifth place, a tie between Joe Biden and Ralph Nader, and Reverend Ron, I think it was, with one vote each. So once again, John Edwards wins the Tom Hartman Program presidential straw poll today. The 30th of November, I think it is. Yeah, today, Friday, the 30th of November, with 36 votes. Dennis Kucinich comes in number two with 32 votes, and Hillary Clinton at 7, and Barack Obama at 7, and everybody else won. Or Al Gore, 3. Everybody else, 1 or fewer, as we go on. A couple of things that I wanted to bring up. I think that this is interesting stuff, and in particular would be interested to get your thoughts on, you know, in general, you know, the topic, as it were. We talk about addictive substances, you know, drugs, for example. Addictive substances have a few characteristics. One is that they are typically not natural substances. Most natural substances are not highly addictive. They may be somewhat addictive. You know, opium, for example, if you just made tea out of poppies, I suppose over time you could become, I don't know from personal experience, but certainly the opium in those poppies over time could lead to an addiction. But when you distill it, when you refine it, when you convert it from a natural substance into essentially a chemical substance and turn it into heroin, it becomes highly addictive. Similar to the coca leaf. I've been down in South America and hung out with people who for, you know, 100 generations have chewed coca leaf and have chewed coca leaf with them. And my experience of it was, you know, chewing coca leaf was pretty much identical to drinking a strong cup of coffee. I mean, that was it. And you know, in its natural state, no big deal. And indigenous people have done it for thousands of years, probably tens of thousands of years. But you concentrate that stuff, you run it through chemical reactions, and you do all this kind of fancy stuff, and you end up with cocaine, or you end up with crack, and you end up with something that's deadly and addictive. So addictive substances meet a couple of criteria. One, they create a craving for more. Two, they're not, you know, typically, they're concentrated reality as opposed to real reality. They're something derived from reality, but they're not the real thing. Three, they alter mood in ways that are measurable. They alter brainwave states. And four, people will actually change their behavior in ways that may not be the very best for them in their lives in order to maintain access to this addictive substance. Now, I have for a long time agreed with Jerry Mander, who wrote a brilliant book on this called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. I wrote a chapter about this in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, back in 1997, suggesting that television is an addictive drug. It's a neurodrug. It's a neurotoxin. It's a neurological substance. But it meets all those criteria. It's a distillation of reality. You see in a 30-minute show, you know, days, weeks in somebody's life. You see a person walking down the street, and you're 40 feet away from them in this camera shot, but you can hear them. You zoom up. You zoom in. You're looking through their eyes. You're looking through somebody else's eyes. It's not reality. It's a concentrated form of reality. It does alter mood, it does create a craving for more, and people do modify their lives to have it available to them. And sometimes at great expense, relatively speaking, not unlike tobacco. I mean, how much does cable TV cost, for example, versus you know, a pack of cigarettes every day? So I've argued for a long time that TV is an addiction. I'm wondering if we're seeing a new kind of addiction. Well, not just wondering. We know that on the fringes this phenomenon is real, of computer addiction. But there's this odd thing over at Facebook, and perhaps other social networking groups, but Facebook is the one that's in the news right now. There is a service associated with Facebook called Beacon, and I'm not sure if – I read this article about this in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago, where this guy just tried it out and was relating his experience, and I got the sense from reading it that it was a separate company from Facebook, but it may be this, you know, one and the same. I frankly don't know. But what it does is you sign up for it, first of all. I mean, you have to sign up for it. And what Beacon does is when you go out and buy something in any of the businesses that are also signed up with Beacon, it will send an email or an IM or post to your profile on Facebook to all your friends who are your list of friends that you just bought that. This guy in the Wall Street Journal, he went out and he bought a giant rabbit costume. And he went to a movie and got a ticket to go to the movie. In fact, he said he looked at the Facebook and Beacon thing for the CEO of Facebook and discovered that the guy that day had bought tickets to see what's the movie with old men in the name, that he went to see that movie. And I really frankly don't know quite yet what to think about all this. I grew up in a generation where people valued their privacy and where the intimate lives of your details of your life, you know, what you buy, where you go, who you're with, what you're doing, were things that were considered private. And it seems, you know, this old fart here, it seems looking at this that this is proxy for intimacy. Gee, I've got 120 friends here, or maybe only five, and they're going to know everything I do, and therefore they know me. It also, and perhaps this in my mind is the most pernicious, psychologically, culturally, the most pernicious and insidious part of this, it causes people to think that who they are is defined by what they consume. Are we a nation of consumers? Now, I'll be the first to tell you, I spent nearly two decades working in the advertising industry in a wide variety of positions, including the CEO of two ad agencies. And in the advertising industry's view, people are very much consumers, and that's what the industry is all about. But people in the ad industry also get that people are other things than consumers. They're parents, their children, their brothers, their sisters, their husbands, their wives, their citizens in their relationship to their government. They're members of society. And I think a well-rounded individual realizes that they're more than just a consumer. And so anyhow, if any of you are using this Beacon with Facebook thing and you think it's a good thing or you think it's a pernicious thing, they've just apparently changed. It used to be that you were automatically opted in and you had to choose to opt out, and apparently they've reversed that. Now you have to opt in, which makes a little more sense. But the entire phenomenon, I think this is just a fascinating thing. And the other thing I wanted to mention is Paul Krugman, his op-ed piece today in the New York Times. Don't miss reading it. This is fascinating. He's talking about Barack Obama's health care plan and how it doesn't cover all Americans. And Edwards' response to that, Obama essentially saying, well, if somebody shows up looking for services or driver's license or something and they're not covered by health insurance, then you penalize them. Edwards says, oh, if they show up looking for that thing, instead of penalizing them, give them insurance. And similarly, Paul Krugman points out that Barack Obama has been using Republican talking points. This is a Republican talking point, basically, that he's been using Republican talking points with regard to Social Security as well. Oh, there's a disaster coming, and it's going to be hard to fix, and it's not. I'm very curious about your thoughts on that. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com, for our blog over at Air America. A lot on the table. There's some interesting comments in the chat room. Bernie Kerik has come out in defense of Rudy Giuliani padding the bill so that the New York Police Department could provide cover for him to have an affair with his then-mistress, while he was married, his now wife. That's just who you want telling the country that you're a moral guy is Bernie Kerik. It's amazing. Yeah. So, John Ashcroft again being confronted about waterboarding. He showed up at Cornell University last night and again got heckled and dissent and whatnot, shouting dissenters and shrouded protesters. John McCain pointing out that Japanese soldiers after World War II were tried and hanged for waterboarding American prisoners of war. Amazing stuff. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tony in England calling. Hey, Tony, thanks for listening to us online. What's up?
Hey, thanks. Nice. Thanks, Tom. The reason I called is that I'm seeing a kind of an analogy here between what we did with the American Indian and what we're doing in Iraq, except there's only one difference, the resource. Before it was land, and now it seems to be oil. As far as sort of bases and embassies, it's kind of like forts and settlements, and the sanctions kind of equated to the diseases and possibly with the depleted uranium, ethnic cleansing, refugees, removal of the American Indian. I'm not seeing much of a big difference, really.
Good point. Yeah, no, it's an excellent analogy or metaphor or whatever, comparison. I mean, yeah, I can't punch a hole in that at all. The same mentality is at work here. This is, you know, Andrew Jackson charging across the West.
And what concerns me is that when I think, if I could go back in time, what would I do to change this? Because I grew up in America, and I want to feel pride for my country, and I feel like it's a Twilight Zone episode. I'm now being confronted with the same thing, but it's a bit different because it's contemporary. You know, maybe, you know, this thing with suicide bombings, but I don't know. I can't quite get my head around this, and it just kind of, you know, it upsets me.
Yeah, and it's also, I'm not sure, the Native American thing was driven by this notion of manifest destiny, that God showed this to us, so therefore we had an obligation to steal it. And, you know, I remember Dick Gregory one time when he and I were traveling over to Uganda, and he was just, you know, we were just talking, and he says, can you imagine? He says, it just amazes me that Americans still talk about, he says that you white people still talk about discovering America. He said, you discovered a country that was already occupied. See, that's like my wife and I walking up to the TV store and saying, look at that TV, Lillian. I think I'll discover it. And it's like, you know, yeah.
Well, that doesn't really work. And I mean, everyone says, well, you know, now we're living in now, and we can't undo the past. Fair enough, but that's my point.
Yeah.
We are living in now, and we have this going on in Iraq, and we're going after their resource, and, you know, we're dividing and conquering, and we're not going to leave until the black stuff's gone, and I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that you just did, Tony, which is raising consciousness, you certainly raised mine. I appreciate that. It's an absolutely brilliant comparison, and I suspect that many of our listeners will carry it out to their friends and neighbors, and we'll see what happens. It's it's one more piece, one more brick in the wall, or vice versa, I guess, taking down one more brick in the wall, to let the light in and see what we're really doing. We have to, you know, Carl Jung talked a lot about it. You have to acknowledge where you're at if you're going to get to the next place you want to be, and we really need to do that as a nation. Tony, thanks a lot. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking the call. I just want to feel pride where I can for being an American, other than jazz and basketball and a few other things that come to mind.
Yeah. Okay. Well, have a great time there in the UK.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Quinn in Sunnyvale, California. Hey, Quinn, what's on your mind today?
Well, I know you were talking about Facebook, and I'm a college student, and Facebook is a very, you know, big part of kind of how I keep in touch with my friends, especially ones who are further away. But there are some very kind of, I guess you could say, scary parts of it. What you were talking about, Beacon, is only one of the applications that you can download off of Facebook. There's over half of the applications that you can download on Facebook have something to do with either products that you like, things that you like, your favorite fashion, your favorite clothes, all consumer-related. And what you find is that there's a lot of kids who are putting on numerous applications so that all their profile is just products that they use and things that they're into. It's kind of
Facebook or any corporation, frankly, would want to encourage the hell out of this, because now they're building a database that they can go to advertisers and say, here, we've got 322,000 people who buy Adidas shoes, so when Adidas comes out with a new shoe, you should be advertising with us. And we've got 1.6 million people who've bought Calvin Klein clothes, so Calvin Klein, you should be advertising with directly. I mean, back when I used to be in the advertising business, I used to do a lot of work in direct mail, and if you just bought a list of you know, everybody who lives in a particular zip code, that list might cost you $35 for 1,000 names. If you bought a list of everybody who subscribes to National Geographic and lives in that zip code, that list might cost you $70 a 1,000 for the names because it's more specific. If you bought a list of everybody who subscribes to National Geographic and is a member of the ACLU and makes more than $100,000 a year in that particular zip code, you could pay $200 a 1,000 for those names, you know, or $300 a 1,000. You get very, very specific information. And so what Facebook is doing apparently, and you know, I can't say this from being inside the company, but just, you know, having been in the advertising and marketing industry and looking at this, it looks like what they're doing is dramatically increasing the value of their database in terms of what they can sell it for when they go out into the open market.
Well, you know, for the past 2 years, what they've been doing is, I remember when Facebook first started, there was absolutely no advertising on it. And now, they have these things where you can see what your friends are up to, what they've been doing recently on their profile. And what they've been doing is every, like, third or fourth one, they embed an advertisement. And in that advertisement, there's a group that you can join, and there's a product that you can go to a website to buy. And it's really become more of that. You know, almost every company has a profile on there and a group that you can join to kind of show your loyalty to. So really what it's becoming.
Yeah, this is building community around consumerism. And, you know, I know it's the hot new thing, social networking. There's seminars all over the place. You've got to change your website and then come out with a social, you know, and get people's pictures on it, blah, 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 blah. And there's something to the idea of people being able to be more highly interactive. I mean, back in the late part of the first half of the 1980s, I was, along with probably about 30 other people, running forums on CompuServe. This was before there was HTML. I remember being in Columbus, Ohio at a CompuServe conference. I was running at that time, I'm not sure which forums I was running. I was running the desktop publishing forum and the attention deficit disorder forum. We had a JFK assassination forum. I ended up running the IBM's forums, the Macintosh forums. I took those over from other people ultimately. And we had a psychology forum. We had, there was just international trade forum. I think there was about 25 of them that I was running at one point. And it was, you know, it was an interesting business. And I remember in the mid 80s going to this meeting at CompuServe headquarters in Columbus, Ohio, where the techies and the CEO of the company, Barry, I'm forgetting his last name right now, rolled out HTML, and we're all sitting there watching this demonstration of hyperlink and hypertext, you know, and we're going, nah, you know, come on, we've got this thing down. We've got forums, and we've got libraries, and we've got, you know, live chat, and this HTML thing is never going to go anywhere, you know, and within a year, the Internet had been essentially rolled out, and now CompuServe is kind of an asterisk in the history of it all. But the steady progression from that point forward has been one of social networking. We used to have meetings once a year where we, you know, for each one of our forums where everybody would get together in Orlando or in Los Angeles or whatever, and people met each other. And I still have friends today who are good friends. In fact, Dave DeBronkert, who edited two of my books, a dear friend of mine, who was one of my sysops on CompuServe. It's how I met him. So I think that there's something to be said for building online communities. It's an incredible and powerful thing. And yet, when the hub of it becomes nothing more or less than what you buy, that seems to me toxic, Quinn.
Well, you know, the benefit is there, and the benefit is clear. The benefit is that, you know, you get to keep in contact with those who normally you wouldn't be able to. And, you know, like you said, 150 friends. I mean, I understand that. You know, I have almost everyone from my high school whose name I remembered as a Facebook friend, but you find that you're only really keeping in touch with about 15 of them. But what it's used for now is not really the social networking part, but really for the advertising part.
Yeah, the marketing part. Yeah, and that concerns me. It concerns me that an entire generation is. And now we've got kids who are coming in who are, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 years old, and this is their first exposure to the world, and this is the community that they're asked to join rather than the community of their neighborhood. I mean, we live in a society where most people don't know the names of their neighbors.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I work in childcare. And, you know, I was talking to one of my kids about, you know, what they watch on television. One of them said, you know, I watch High School Musical. I had heard about it through, you know, MySpace had an advertisement for it. And they think that's a realistic depiction of what high school is going to be for them. It's High School Musical, what's on Disney.
Wow.
That's kind of scary. You know?
Yeah, it is. Quinn, thanks a lot for the call. Thought-provoking topic. I appreciate it. Thank you. Mandates and mudslinging. Paul Krugman's piece today. Check that out. Is Is social networking an addiction? No, this is a human impulse, but can it be turned into something pernicious? And what else is going on in the world? What's up with 1955?
See the children run as the sun goes down among the fields of gold. You remember
9.5 minutes before the hour? That's nice. Nice way to get back into a second. George in Denver, Colorado. Thanks for calling. What's up, George? And
hello?
Thanks for listening to KKZN. What's up?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, is this Tom?
It is, I am.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Hi, yeah, I just wanted to follow up on your conversation about with the caller who was making the comparison to the conquest of America. But I think that there's some differences. And what I think one big difference is that I don't think the people of America were so enthused about that. I think it was more of a business government kind of a thing. But people kind of got seduced into it, like, say, for example, with the Homestead Act. But another example is that when the early settlers of Europe got here, whites and blacks worked alongside as indentured servants, and they both rebelled against the slave masters, and then the slave masters were able to manipulate them with offers for early freedom and turn them against the black slaves. And that's kind of what our history has been about. A lot of people have been getting government favors.
There was a significant difference, though, George. I lived in Vermont for 10 years, and the whole story of indentured servitude is really very different. I mean, a lot of people who came to the Northeast came as indentured servants, particularly Irish and Scots and whatnot, and they would trade 5 years, 7 years, 15 years of their life in exchange for passage and a place to live and food to eat. That's different from being told that you and your children and your children's children and their children's children are forever going to be slaves. It's a very different thing.
Well, the point is that the early indentured servants, both black and white, had it really bad. And then the offer of freedom was made a little more attractive than as compared to the black slaves.
But even to the whites who came over as members of penal colonies, I mean, keep in mind, everybody knows that Australia was a penal colony. The state of Georgia was a penal colony for the United Kingdom in the 1600s. And even those folks who came over, if they were white, eventually they could earn their freedom and their children would be free more often than not. Whereas if they were black, to this day, many would argue that they're not free.
Right. I'm just saying that part of the reason for that was because it was made more attractive to whites so that they would turn against the black slaves, and that at one point in time, they had it just, pretty close to as bad.
Disagree that the powers that be were playing one group off against the other, but we can't dismiss easily or handily the reality of the deeply, deeply ingrained racism that's been part of the culture of this country since its very beginning and is still alive and well.
I would have to concede with that. But on the other hand, another point I want to make is that I think another big difference is that we have so much more to lose by invading the Middle East or invading Iraq and Afghanistan, and look at what we've lost already, and the state of our economy. I mean, it's going to be a much more expensive venture than the conquest of America.
Than just stealing land from Native Americans, from American Indians. Yeah, you're right, George. You're absolutely right. And thus all the more the tragedy. Richard, thanks for the call. Richard in Satellite Beach, Florida. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Good. Hey, I was thinking about the notebook topic. Is really an interesting one to me because...
Facebook?
The Facebook, right, thanks, topic is really interesting to me because, while there's a lot of talk about the corporate aspect of it, which is certainly true, I think what I look at as being more important about this is how it points to, for me, a really crucial human need, and that's the need to be known. And, I think ideally we should fill this need with knowing ourselves and knowing something greater than ourselves, essentially the core of what's at life. But, and so I think that's why we have this need to put ourselves out there and to post everything about our lives. And I put forth the idea of that perhaps maybe the less we know about ourselves, maybe the less in touch with our lives and our purpose we are, maybe the greater the need is to be known in such a way and put even more of your life online because of the sense of, like, maybe topical.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, Richard. You know, back in the late part of the 19th century, Carl Jung defined this. He actually invented the words introversion and extroversion. And or introvert and extrovert. And most people think that an introvert is somebody who is, you know, very, very facile in front of a large group of people or kind of loud or whatever. And an extrovert. And an introvert is somebody who's quiet and soft spoken. But actually what Jung, his definition was that an extrovert is somebody who knows who they are by virtue of other people's reaction to them. In other words, they derive their sense of self from what other people tell them about who they are. And so they're constantly trying to interact with others in a way to cause others to think of them in a particular way so that they feel that that's who they are. Now, it's a self-initiated feedback loop. Whereas an introvert is somebody who has a core sense of self and simply operates out of that and, you know, gets input and feedback from others but doesn't use that to define for themselves who they are. So you wonder if, and there is that scale. I mean, the Myers-Briggs test, there's other tests that you can use to determine whether you're an introvert or an extrovert and where you are on that scale. And it's why extroverts tend to be very outspoken and tend to be, you know, reaching out all the time and, you know, trying to get feedback from people about how great they are, or they talk about how great they are a lot because they fundamentally don't know who they are.
Right.
And so it may well be, Richard, that those people who are classic extroverts in the Carl Jung sense would be the most vulnerable to something like what Facebook is up to.
For sure.
Yeah, interesting concept. Thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Richard. Good to hear from you. We'll continue. Anything Goes Friday, right after the news break here at the top of the hour. 57 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here. Tom Hartman with you. Our straw poll, the Tom Hartman Program Progressive Straw Poll, Democratic primary straw poll results are posted. Louise posted them over at airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page. She says, please announce this so people will stop emailing me for results. You can go over to airamerica.com and click on my name on or on, you know, whatever, however you do it, the bar that takes you to the Tom Hartman page. And There's Louise's blog there, and she has posted the results of our straw poll. Here's what they were, just for those of you who are just tuning in. We did this in the first segment of the first hour, or of the last hour of the program. And it was John Edwards won at 36 votes, Dennis Kucinich 32 votes, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton 7 votes each, Al Gore 3 votes, Joe Biden and Ralph Nader 1 vote each. So that was the result. And just a heads up, I'm broadcasting live today from K-Talk, our affiliate here in Los Angeles, KTLK. And thanks so much, folks, for the studio space. Tonight, I'll be in Oak Park at the California Ventura County Democrats Speakers Series at 7 to 9 p.m. That's at 1000 Canaan, or Cannon Road, K-A-N-A-N Road in Oak Park. And it's open to the public. You're welcome to show up. And we'll be talking. I'll be doing a riff on two of my books, on Screwed and on Cracking the Code. Also, on December 6th, I'll be at the Willamette Store at 2 p.m. at a discussion and book signing. This is at Willamette University, 900 State Street in Salem, Oregon. And on December 14th, we'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota at 7 p.m. at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at the Kauffman Memorial Union. So that's what's going on here in my world these days. Just a final note on introversion and extroversion. We were discussing just before the break. You can't always tell unless you're really drilling down into the sense of, you know, how does a person define who they are? I was astounded the first time I took a Myers-Briggs test. This was like 15 years ago. And I'm an extreme introvert. But I've learned over the years, over the many years of my life, how to pretend very effectively, how to do the performance of you know, appearing to be an extrovert. And the thing that has fascinated me is that I find that to be so true of so many people in radio. I know a lot of people in radio who are introverts. I don't want to name names, but, you know, you can probably figure it out, actually, if you think about it. Several of my colleagues at Air America who are introverts, and yet the extroverts seem to gravitate to television. You know, Bill O'Reilly, a classic case. I think he's a classic extrovert. So it's just an interesting observation. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Bill in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk right here in the city where I am. What's up, Bill?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Just want to thank you for your great show. So informative.
Thank you.
I had a question about Al Gore, who doesn't seem to be part of the primaries, but can he still be nominated at the Democratic convention?
I don't think so. Because there will be so many delegates who are already committed to a particular nominee. I don't think that this will be a brokered convention. And even if it were, I frankly, and then that would require Al Gore actually, you know, saying that he wants to be running for president in 2008. And frankly, I don't think he does. I mean, listening to what the guy says, when he came to Portland, I introduced him for his Inconvenient Speech Truth. This was about a year ago. And then moderated a Q&A with him for about an hour afterwards and spent some time with him backstage beforehand. One of the first questions that was asked during the Q&A was, will you run for president? And I was standing 3 feet from him, and just he sighed. I mean, his whole body just kind of sunk a little bit. You know, I just got it. This guy has been so wounded by this experience that he just doesn't want to go there again. And that was my take. I mean, you know, I realize I'm playing amateur shrink here at all of our risks, but I just don't think he's going to. You know, he's going to be there.
I just wondered about the process, and in the end, the delegates could make a change.
No, they can't. Although this brings up another issue, and that is, and I've been meaning to write an op-ed about this for some time, is that I think that we should do away with primaries and go back to the smoke-filled rooms. And the reason why is because primaries have become who raises the most money to buy the most advertising. And it's the money race, and the corporations, both the media corporations and the corporations who are making the donations, are becoming the ones who drive the primary process. Whereas if you have the proverbial smoke-filled rooms, in other words, if the people who are on the inside at the various political parties at the local level all get together and say, okay, for our state, who are we going to nominate? Then you're going to get the actual activists, the people who have shown up at the Democratic Party meetings or the Republican Party meetings, if they did it as well. And you know, this is how the Green Party does it in many states. You're going to get the people who showed up at the meetings and actually are committed and actually care, and they're going to be the ones making the decisions without the external force of millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars of advertising. And frankly, I think that would be a healthy thing. I'm very concerned about the fact that we've got a primary system that has now been co-opted by corporate money and is a multi-million dollar machine, frankly. So, time will tell. Sure, Bill.
About the machine, do you think that the powers that be are only going to let a nominee be the person who will not prosecute the Bush administration for their crimes?
I sure hope not. I sure hope not. There's little doubt in my mind that, well, I just don't know, Bill. I know that the conventional wisdom is that when you have a new administration, you turn your back on the past, you look toward the future, and you start walking into the light, you know. And there's a real just, you know, Bill Clinton stopping the prosecutions of Iran-Contra and the investigations when he came into office. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see that happen again. I think it would be a terrible mistake. I think one of the biggest mistakes that was made in the 20th century was when Gerry Ford decided to pardon Richard Nixon. It it prevented us from experiencing closure, and the message that is said to every future president, and it certainly was one that was not lost by George W. Bush, is if you commit crimes, you can get away with it. And, you know, it would be a terrible thing. And we need to hold our elected officials accountable. And it's a question that, frankly, I think should be asked of people who are running in the Democratic primary. But
I have a vote for John Edwards, too. So.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Bill. Good to hear from you. 1-866-303-2270. Ed in San Diego. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I wanted to bring out one point. Now Henry Hyde has just passed, and he was mentioned on Rachel and John's programs last night. However,
just passed as in just died.
Yeah,
passed on.
Henry Hyde, and so they brought out that he was a hypocrite worse than Clinton, but nobody brought out the point that the guy who had a lot to do with us retaining Clinton as president was Larry Flynt in the Flynt Report published in 1999, and that he brought out all of this information, and it's brought out information on many Republicans. And so he never gets any credit, and I know that Clinton thanked them because I talked to Larry Flynt personally myself, and I just felt that that should get aired. That was my point.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ed. I had lunch yesterday with Bruce David, who's an editor at Hustler and a friend. And I knew Larry Flynt back in the 70s. I mean, he before he was shot, and he was a very progressive guy and a very good guy. I have a lot of respect for Larry Flynt, and he outed Henry Hyde and a bunch of the others as well. And these guys were, you know, what they were doing was downright bizarre. I mean, you know, Newt Gingrich and the whole bunch of them going after Bill Clinton for doing something that frankly was not as extreme as what they were doing themselves. And, you know, but I think this is what, with Henry Hyde, this is one of those areas where you can say, let's not speak ill of the dead and let's move on. But you're right. Larry Flynt deserves the credit. And, so Larry, here's to you. Maury in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Maury, we got about a half a minute here before we got to take a break.
Yes. Well, I have a question. Sometime back 2-3 days ago, I had a big discussion about the fetus and when does a human become a human, and it was very lively, and I enjoyed it because I have my own take on it. At the end of that, you mentioned the word soul, and then I got thinking about it. I said, well, what the hell does a he mean by the word soul? And in my take on life in general is that if you can't measure it or can't count it, it's not real.
Yeah. Then radio waves aren't. Well, I guess you can measure them. But Maury, I'll pick this up on the other side of the break. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Anything goes.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday. The question of our last caller, what is the soul? I have to say, I don't know. I remember when I was young, Sufi Sam, this guy in San Francisco. I don't know if he's still around. I'm guessing he's long gone, but he had this the great goulash theory that when people die, their identities and their experiences and everything kind of goes into this giant goulash pot, and when somebody's born, the creator, as it were, puts a ladle into the pot and pulls out some of the goulash and pours it into that new person, and so we're all kind of part of everything, you know. It's and therefore we all have an obligation to make the goulash pot brighter and lighter and that echoes down into the future. And then you got, you know, folks like Edgar Cayce, you know, the sense of continuity and reincarnation, the Buddhist idea and the Hindu idea of reincarnation time after time after time. In Judaism, the concept of an afterlife is very, very weakly defined. In Christianity, it's more highly defined, although it's not, you know, up in the clouds with a harp. I mean, there's not a clear definition of it. That I've ever seen or found. I just don't know. I had an experience many years ago. I was sitting meditating, and all of a sudden, it was a cold, beautiful, beautiful winter evening in Michigan, and sitting looking out through this picture window onto a snowscape, and all of a sudden, I just had this sense that whatever was me, just started expanding out. It went out beyond the house and out beyond the neighborhood, and just continued going out and out and out for miles. I mean, just encompassing everything. It was this absolute sense of everything that exists is looking through me, is looking through my body, through my physical body. It's looking out my eyes. It's hearing with my ears, and it's everything. It's all the intelligence of all creation. And I can't quite touch that place, but I still remember it very clearly. My friend Michael Hutchison in Santa Fe had a similar experience. He writes about it. You can find there's a whole article about him and that experience over on TomHartmann.com. And if you search on Michael Hutchison, Hutchison. And only his experience was much deeper, much more profound, and lasting, continuous and lasting. I think he's had the enlightenment experience, the experience the Buddha had. But you know what that means, what the soul is. I don't know. You know, if you got some thoughts, you're welcome to share them with us. Mike in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Occurred to me a while back. Remember, in the fall of 2001, we had that thing with the anthrax attacks?
Yep. Just in time to push the Patriot Act through.
Yeah, exactly.
And the only two guys who could have stopped the Patriot Act were Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. Patrick Leahy was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee it had to get out of,
uh-huh.
and Tom Daschle was the head of the Democrats in the Senate, who then controlled the Senate because of Jim Jeffords flipping, and so he had to say, yes, we'll put this to a floor vote. And they were the only two guys who got the anthrax.
Yes.
I mean, in the Senate.
Yeah, looking at it, it should be fairly simple to figure out what the source was, because every bacterial culture has distinctive genetic fingerprints to it.
Right. Well, we know it was weaponized. It was from the U.S. military. Didn't it come from Fort Detrick? Wasn't it traced back to there?
I heard rumors to that effect, but I just didn't hear anything solid. But ordinarily, that stuff has a very tight chain of custody on it. You'd be able to figure out the names of all the people who were involved with it, and then you just proceed with an investigation.
Perhaps they already have.
Ah, yes.
This
isn't a conspiracy theory or anything, is it?
I would put nothing past these guys. I'd put absolutely nothing past these guys.
Right. If they did it once, why couldn't they do it again?
Yeah. Well, and I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop between now and the November elections. Whether it's going to be the invasion of Iran in April, which is, you know, Scott Ritter is saying, hey, this is going to happen. You're going to see the invasion in April. That's when that's when the bombers are going to be retrofitted. That's, you know, blah, 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 blah. Whether it's going to be that, or whether it's going to be another terrorist attack, or whether it's going to be another anthrax attack or whatever. I don't know, but I am quite confident another shoe is going to drop. Cheryl in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Cheryl, we've got about a minute here before we have to take a break at the bottom of the hour.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that your guest yesterday spoke very eloquently about the dangers of H.R. 1955.
Yes, Odette Wilkins.
Right, yes. And, you know, I find it ironic that this law most epitomizes the Bush regime itself. And people should know that there's a section of the law, specifically Section 899B, and it purports to assure that constitutional and civil rights won't be violated. But the Bush regime has a proven track record of the most radical and criminal program in our nation's history.
Right. H.R. 1955, which is now Senate Bill 1959, and that's really where we need to focus our effort. This is, you could say, well, that's a gun. That hasn't been fired. It's not pointed at me, but it's a gun. And it's a gun that we're handing to the Bush administration, Cheryl, and they've got enough. They don't need any more weapons to use against us. Thank you very much for raising the issue. Well said. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann with you. Anything Goes Friday. Stick around.
The Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick reminder, tonight, Oak Park, California, Ventura County Democrats Speaker Series, 7 p.m. I'll be speaking at 1000 Cannon Road in Oak Park, 7 to 9 p.m. It's free and open to the public, although they do accept contributions for the party. December 6th, I'll be at the Willamette Store at 2 p.m., a discussion about Cracking the Code, my new book, and a book signing. That's at Willamette University, 900 State Street in Salem, Oregon. And on December 14th, Minneapolis, Minnesota, the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union. That'll be at 7 p.m. on the 14th of December. 1-866-303-2270. And Norman in Los Angeles, you want to disagree with me, so you go to the front of the line. What's up?
No, no, I don't want to disagree with you, but
Oh, now I got to put you in the back of the line?
No, I was in the front row last night in Santa Monica, so I'm going to stay there. You were terrific
right.
last night. But
well,
the reason
you.
I called is I respectfully want to correct what I think you said about the convention. There's a very strong possibility that the Democratic Party is going to go to the Denver convention without a majority candidate.
Why do you think that is?
Because on February 5th, there's 22 states are going to have their primary, and no one's going to carry all 22 states. And by that date, 60% of the primaries will be done. And it looks to me like it's a 2 or 3 person race. And they're going to go in. And by the way, there's a large contingent of people at the primary who are not committed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to go back to.
So you think this could be a brokered convention?
I hope so.
Yeah.
And,
well, the benefit, the upside of a brokered convention is that it gets back to the point that I was making earlier, is that it's instead of having people who are influenced by the most advertising out there making the decision, you've got the people who are the most committed to the party, who have been doing the work, who've been on the ground, who have met the candidates, who've invested their time and effort in really learning and understanding who these people are and who would make a good president and who has the best chance of beating the Republican. And that, I think, is a healthy thing.
Well, from my point of view, it's an open door for Al Gore. And if not him,
if he wanted to walk through it,
well, he will. The man. I don't care what we've said so far. He has not received his Nobel Prize, and he's got to feel the responsibility of doing this. But that's beside the point. I think also it will maybe help take the decision of who would be the nominee out of the money. Because the biggest problem in both the whole primary system is money.
Well, that was my point.
Yeah,
the money is driving the advertising, and absolutely.
Easy.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, Norman, and we'll all keep our eyes open on this one. Thank you very much for the call, Michael in Manhattan. Hey, Michael.
Hi, I wanted to discuss basically the same thing that Norman just talked about. He made a very good point in that there isn't time between the New Hampshire and Iowa. Caucus and primary for momentum to build for someone by the February 5th date when, as he said, 60% of the delegates will already have been apportioned. There's another way that you can actually get to, by decision, a brokered candidacy, and that's if you go back to a favorite son kind of situation. Of course, we have to get rid of that terminology, but, you could have, like, Barbara
Favorite son or daughter, you mean?
Barbara Boxer could run in California. She wouldn't have to devote any of her time or resources to going anywhere else. She could make it clear she doesn't want to be president. She just wants to take, 30, 40, 50% of California's delegates to the convention with her so that she could bargain with them.
Yeah.
Same thing could happen in Pennsylvania where Ed Rendell is the governor and he's term limited. He could run as a favorite son. In New York, Mario Cuomo could run as a favorite son. And again, 30, 40% of the delegates from the 10 or 15 largest states.
But realistically, I understand the process, Michael. Realistically speaking, though, I don't see any of those people doing that. Do you?
No, this time around, absolutely not.
Yeah.
But the parties could make the decision that that's a very good way to proceed and encourage in the next round, when we don't have an incumbent.
My big concern, actually, you and Michael, thanks for raising this and for mentioning it, but what this raises for me is this other huge flag, this article in The Independent yesterday or the day before. We've talked about on this program a number of times back when it was just a gleam in the eye of Rudy Giuliani's advisors. A year ago we were talking about it on this program, and now it looks like it's actually going to happen, and that's this California Counts initiative, ballot initiative that's being promoted by the Republic, by a group of Republican insiders, particularly a group of Republican insiders connected to Giuliani, that will cause some significant percentage, 30, 40, 50%, well, it wouldn't be 50%, but 30 or 40%, perhaps as many as 45% of the California members of the Electoral College, the electoral votes for the state of California, to go Republican rather than, you know, winner take all for the state. Now, in Texas, 100%, you know, all of the votes will go for the Republicans. In Florida, all of the votes will go for the Republicans, or in, you know, in other reliably Republican states. Florida may be in play this year, who knows, but in Texas, certainly. But so what they're trying to do is they're trying to split up California. And if they do that, it's like knocking four or five states out of the Democratic category. It's going to make it very, very difficult for a Democrat to win the Electoral College. A Democrat could win the majority vote hugely, like Al Gore did, you know, millions of votes. But if you don't win the Electoral College, you're not president. And this incredibly sneaky effort by the Republicans there was a great reprint of the Independent article on Common Dreams yesterday, and it's really worth tracking down and reading. Regina in L.A. Hey, Regina.
Hello. I just wanted to get back to what you were talking about, the conception of the soul, and why I find it to be kind of a suspicious idea. I'm an animal rights person. I've been a vegetarian for 20 years now. I hate to say that, but 20 years. And I remember I went to a talk at a local agricultural college that was given by an animal rights philosopher. And I remember one of the comments from one of the students at the end of the talk was basically, haven't you ever heard of a soul? The soul is what differentiates humans from animals. And I got from that that the soul is really the idea that allows human beings to, you know, do whatever they want with impunity.
Yeah.
Because we have souls and others don't, and that's pretty much it. We don't know what it is, but we know it when we don't see it, or we know it when we see it, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a suspicious notion, in my opinion.
I agree, Regina, and there's a story. It's either in my book, The Prophet's Way, or in The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I tell this story. My mentor, the man who for the last, well, since 1978, how many ever years that is, has been one of the biggest influences in my life. His name is Gottfried Müller. He's now 93 years old. He lives in Germany, and he became a vegetarian in the 40s during World War II. I've been a vegetarian, I think, a decade longer than you. Since I was 16, which was in 1966.
Oh,
67.
I got to be, yeah.
But in any case, he sent me a fax one day. Every Friday we send each other Shabbat Shalom fax. His mentor was a Hasidic Jew by the name of Avram Poyak. And so he sent me this Shabbos fax, and he said, Thomas, I figured out how to look into the face of God. If you'd like to know, you know, come visit me. So I hopped on a plane and I went over to Germany, and he said, let's go for a walk. And we're out walking in the forest. And he says, I've been really thinking about this. He says, when you look into another person's face, how do you know who they really are? How do you know what their soul is?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, probably their eyes. And he said, yeah, I think that's it. He said, when you look into the eyes of another person, what's looking back at you is God. And he said, when you're looking into the eyes of a dog or a cat, what's looking back at you is God. He said, when you look into the eyes of a housefly, what's looking back at you is God. And as we're walking along, he stroked a leaf that was, you know, just kind of leaning out over the path, over the trail, some grass. And he said, and these leaves, they move with the sun. They know how to see somehow. This is the face of God, too. And he just made this kind of sweeping gesture and looked around and he said, this is all the face of God. And you know, there's your soul. I mean, it's
right.
That web of life, that fire of life. That's, you know, if I had to make a declaration, you know, if Dick Cheney was going to waterboard me and say, you know, make a proclamation about the soul, that would be it. But
right.
But that's as far as I can go with, you know, I with any Anything
that, well, it
does
get down to that. Sometimes people will say, well, you know, those people have no soul, right? That's another reason why we can torture them or, you know.
Well, that's actually the argument that was made, you know, back in the day to justify slavery and to justify the extermination of Native Americans was that, well, they're somehow not as evolutionarily high as we had. And the Mormon religion for a long time believed that the mark of Cain was black skin and mm-hmm. thus justified excluding Mormons from that religion. I mean, that's been changed since I think the 1950s or 60s, but, you know, So
my solution to this has been, you know, the Buddhist solution, which is, you know, the no soul path, you know. But
now, how does Buddhism comport with no soul? When, you know, I spent a week with the Dalai Lama and he was reincarnated, these are the 13th incarnations, uh-huh. I recall. I mean, they found him as a little kid and said, "Aha! The Buddha of compassion has reincarnated." There's
right.
got to be a soul there in Buddhism.
What reincarnates?
Yeah. Well, there you go. Regina, right. Thanks a lot for the call. It's fascinating topic. 45 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our number, TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our blog.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Rosen and Lauren Kirshner at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, to Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening, and to John Fish for driving me around L.A. for 2 days. Thank you all so very much. It is much appreciated. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com in Washington, D.C. is on the line with us. Hey, Victoria, happy Friday.
A very happy Friday to you, Tom. Very happy Friday to you. It's a day of anniversaries, actually, today. It is, as I'm sure you know, the 14th anniversary of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yes.
A day that is being marked by a rally on the Mall here in Washington, D.C. And as I'm sure you know, 28 retired generals and admirals are releasing a letter today urging Congress to repeal the law, something that's not going to happen anytime soon. Meantime, the president went to Mount Airy, Maryland, to the Calvary United Methodist Church, where he made a major speech on AIDS, tomorrow being World AIDS Day. And he announced that he will be making a trip to Africa early next year, partly in connection with AIDS.
Is he trying to one-up Hillary? She just gave a speech at a mega church on AIDS and Rick Warren's church, the guy who wrote A Purpose Driven Life.
I think it's all AIDS all the time today, as a matter of fact, being World AIDS Day tomorrow. So there was an odd, maybe I found it odd because there's something wrong with me. There was an odd paragraph, I thought, in the speech where he talked about how Americans feel a duty to respond to the suffering of AIDS, where he contrasted the two feelings that Americans have. He said some are motivated by conscience and the conviction that America should use its great influence to be a force for good. Many others are driven by faith, by the call to love your neighbor as yourself, even when that neighbor may live on the other side of the world. It seemed to me that he was separating Americans into two groups here.
Right, the secular and the religious.
Right, and I found that disconcerting. And as you read the speech further on, there is a tremendous emphasis on faith-based organizations in this speech. And in fact, what he talks about is the prevention of the faith-based organizations, the prevention message based on the proven principles, as he refers to, of ABC, which is abstinence, be faithful, and use condoms, which they say has been a tremendous success.
Yeah. It's tragic that the leader of the arguably one of the world's largest secular organizations, institutions, the government of the United States of America, would be pitching religion rather than, you know, talking about what can be done by the people, you know, through the use of democratic institutions.
I mean, he he does talk about democratic institutions to some extent, but he does to a great extent talk about what volunteers can do, and what people going over as individuals or with their churches can do.
Yeah.
I
think democracy is something that he's not particularly comfortable with. I think when he said this would be a whole lot easier if it was a dictatorship, just as long as he's a dictator, that he was just speaking the absolute truth.
I don't want to comment on that.
Yeah, okay. All right, what else is going on? Yeah, I know, you're the reporter. I'm the commentator here.
You're the commentator. Well, yesterday, of course, he had a meeting in what's known as the tank over at the Pentagon, and he warned Congress that the Pentagon's soon going to have to start laying off civilian employees. He says that the Defense Secretary has directed the Army and the Marine Corps to develop a plan to start laying off civilian employees, to terminate contracts, and to prepare the military bases across the country for reduced operations. Now, of course, the Democrats are saying that President Bush is refusing to fund his own war. The rhetoric is only going to get stronger on this, as we're going to see the two sides really hunker down for a very, very nasty fight on this.
Yeah. Bush is doing the National Lampoon. Buy this magazine or we'll shoot this dog.
Basically, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Pretty grim.
That's pretty much what we're going to see. I imagine that you've been talking about Senator Joe Biden's statement that he will move to impeach President Bush if he bombs Iran without congressional approval.
No, I hadn't mentioned it. You know, he said that also in the last Democratic debate, and I was astounded that it was completely ignored.
It's only since he said it a second time that it's really been picked up. You're right. He did say it in the debate, and it's since he said it yesterday that he now says that as foreign relations chairman, if he attacks unilaterally Iran, I will move to impeach.
Yeah. Well, actually, as a senator, he can't move to impeach. That has to originate in the House of Representatives. But he can certainly support the House in moving to impeach, which means, I guess, he has to go have a conversation with Nancy Pelosi and John Conyers.
And John Conyers, I think, would probably be with him on this. Pelosi, I don't know. She might be. If she felt that this was in her interest, I think she might well be.
Yeah. That's a pretty strong statement, you know, particularly given that the best guess is that if George actually does unilaterally strike Iran, he's going to do it in April. And I mean, that's, you know, right in the teeth of a presidential election campaign, because by that time, in all probability, there will be the nominees for the two parties and they'll be beating each other up. And I wonder what's the conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C. about whether being at war will help the Democrats or the Republicans with a third country in the Middle East?
The sense is that it would traditionally help the Republicans. The feeling, though, is that all bets are off this time, because with wars going badly and with people exhausted by war, it could, for the very first time, help the Democrats.
Yeah. Well, that would be, you know, a turn toward peace, a national turn toward peace would be just such a healthy thing. You know, John Kennedy talked so eloquently and so often about peace, but he was speaking to the generation that remembered the horrors of World War II, by and large. And that had not yet seen the horrors of Vietnam that were to come. And it's just, boy, we need to have a national dialogue about peace again rather than just about war all the time as a positive force. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks so much for sharing
Thank you very much.
Always great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And thank you to all of you for listening. Coming up Monday on the program, where did it go? I had my notes here someplace, and now... they're there. Here we go. Peter DiLorenzo is going to drop by on his new book, The United States of Toyota, How Detroit Squandered His Legacy. I wonder if he's going to take me to task for owning a Prius. And Pat Buchanan will be by on his new book, Day of Reckoning. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag.